A Life of Jesus by Brother Melva Purkis. Book 1, Chapter 4, Jerusalem. The only recorded incident of the early life of Jesus is the adventure in Jerusalem at the age of 12. Several reasons may be found to explain this jewel, which shines in so lovely a light against a background of 30 silent years. At the age of 12, a Jewish boy becomes a son of the law with privileges and responsibilities, which included an attendance at the Passover in Jerusalem every year. The greatest reason which sweeps the others up in its embrace would seem to be that this experience, which Luke records, and which enshrines the first recorded words of Jesus, marks the point in his life when the significance of his relationships was revealed to him, and he dedicated himself unreservedly to his Father's will. Each year, Jesus would have watched his parents' preparation for the journey to Jerusalem with thoughtful eyes. His knowledge of Scripture was growing, and with that growth would come an ever clearer perception of the significance of God's requirements. He would know that his people were a favoured race, that God had chosen them to be a special people unto himself, a favour which bore no relation to their size or strength, but was an evidence of his faithfulness to his covenant, and of a love which was not influenced by the unresponsiveness of those who were the objects of it. With eager eyes, Jesus would follow the record of his people's history. He would burn with shame as he read of their waywardness and marvel at the forbearance of God. He would sense the warmth of God's favour for Jerusalem, whose very stones were precious in his sight. On reading the prophets, he would see the end of the Lord. The Passover epitomised all these things. To many boys of 12, its significance would have rested upon the Lord's deliverance of his people from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. But the attention of Jesus would turn to the lamb of the first year without blemish, and to its blood upon the lintels and the doorposts. His appreciation of deliverance would reach beyond the limitations imposed by the power of men, and meditating upon the work of the prophet like unto Moses, he would see a twofold deliverance. He would ponder for hours over the sacrifice of the lamb and the efficacy of the blood-sprinkled doors. He would perhaps know the scroll of Isaiah by heart, and although his whole being would thrill at the majesty and power of Messiah's work, and the joy and peace he was to bring as the strong arm of God, he would read and meditate upon every word of the 53rd chapter, and recognize, as the Messiah, Jehovah's servant, who was oppressed and afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. But Jesus would see too something of the triumph of that sacrifice. God had said concerning him, "By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities." The sacrifice being made, the justification of many being accomplished, the Messiah was to have the wonderful experience of seeing the travail of his soul and feeling the satisfaction of all that had been done to prepare men for the revealed glory of God. The day dawned for which Jesus had waited, and the preparations for the journey were complete. Before the first light of dawn, the household would be astir, Joseph feeding and grooming the ass, Mary preparing the food and bedding, Jesus quietly helpful until all was ready, and the little company made their way down the familiar street to the well, where the rest of the village families were fast assembling. Amid good wishes, farewells, and some envious longings, the cavalcade moved away, climbing steadily toward the southern edge of the sheltering basin, whence the rocky path led downwards toward the plain of Esdraelon and the south. It would not be long before other companies from all over Galilee would be seen wending their way across the plain. Occasionally, they would overtake pilgrims whose strange dress and travel-tired eyes and Greek tongue proclaimed them Jews of the dispersion. From every point of the compass, the people of God were converging upon his city. Jerusalem, like a meteoric lodestone, was drawing men and women to her heart. Ploughs stood idle in the fields, vineyards and olive groves were deserted, merchants' shops were shuttered, carpenters' tools were silent. Jerusalem had claimed her people, and even now was filling and overflowing to the hills around. Large companies of pilgrims often followed the third route through Samaria, which took them over the rough desert scrub into the plain of Dothan, across dry riverbeds, along stone wadis, into the Samaritan hills between the twin heights of Ebal and Gerizim, towards the featureless plateau on which Bethel stands. To Jesus, the journey would be a memorable one, for the servants of God would emerge from the past as Joseph pointed out the familiar places which witnessed their activities, and the barren landscape would become instinct with life and movement as the thought of the struggles, hardships and faith which had earned for them the favour of God. There would be darker scenes recalled by some historic spots, scenes made more real by the gleams of hatred and scarcely veiled hostility the boy had seen on the faces of many of the people of Samaria as they passed through. But now, as the sun passed its zenith on the third day, the thoughts of Jesus moved more quickly than his tiring feet and reached forward in eager anticipation to the city of God. The words of the psalmist describe the deep, almost unutterable emotions of the Son of the Law as he approached the holy city for the first time. I was glad when they said unto me, Let us go into the house of the Lord. Our feet shall stand within thy gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem is builded as a city that is compact together. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They shall prosper that love thee. Peace be within thy walls, and prosperity within thy palaces. These deep feelings would stir the sensitive spirit of Jesus a hundredfold, and when at last the walls and strong towers of the city lay before him, he would drink in the visible portrayal of years of reading, thought and prayer. Joseph, that great type of Israel's Messiah, had dreamed as a boy of his great destiny when even his parents and brethren would worship him. Such thoughts may well have mingled with Jesus' dreams as he looked down for the first time upon the city which held so much in store for him. There may have been a strange sense of foreboding too. A lamb was to be slaughtered on the morrow. There would be little room to spare in the city that night, and the pilgrims from Galilee would probably spend the night outside the city walls, sleeping in the open on the slopes of Olivet. The first rays of the Passover dawn were heralded by a trumpet peals from the temple precincts. They would be a signal for general activity, and after a hasty meal, Joseph and Mary would take Jesus down the hillside, and mingling with the vast crowds from nearly 50 countries, would enter the city gate and climb as quickly as the moving mass and the narrow streets would allow. As they approached the temple precincts, they would be conscious of the confusion of sounds. The bleating of lambs, the bellowing of calves, and the cooing of doves mingled with the cries of men. Voices were raised in sharp exchanges. There were accusations of theft and treachery, countered by threats and challenges. Such a spectacle was not a happy introduction to the house of God, and probably Jesus felt disturbed as he watched Joseph purchase a lamb and followed him under the great colonnades of the court of the Gentiles, up the stone steps to the inner court of the temple, and on through one of the nine temple gates into the court of the women. But his thoughts were no longer interrupted by the vulgar cries below as he stood on the sacred spot that God had chosen that his name might be there. It was on this rock that Abraham had shown the faith of complete dedication in offering his son of promise in obedience to God's command. It was here that Solomon had received divine instructions to build a house in which God should dwell. It was here that, the building being furnished, mortal man reached his highest point in communion with his Maker. Behold, heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain thee, how much less this house which I have built. Have respect, therefore, to the prayer of thy servant, that thine eyes may be open upon this house day and night. It was here that God accepted the petitions of his people in a glory which filled the house, preventing the entrance of the priests. The words of the psalmist may have found an echo in his youthful heart. One thing have I desired of the Lord, and that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. His mind may have spanned the centuries yet to be when God's house would be a house of prayer for all nations, when the knowledge of God's glory would fill the earth and the law should go forth from Zion. That evening, when the noises of the city were stilled and thousands of pilgrims had returned to their apartments within the city or to their tents on the hills outside, excitement gave way to great solemnity. The Passover was kept. The lamb was roasted and eaten with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. The traditional questions from the youngest member of the family, "What mean ye by this service?" evoked a stirring account of God's deliverance of his people, probably extending beyond the experiences of their ancestors in Egypt, to a rehearsal of his guiding hand throughout their long, eventful history. The struggles in the land of promise, the Elysian days under David and Solomon, the bitterness and strife of the divided kingdom, the final penalty for disobedience and the overwhelming thirst of Israel, and then of Judah by foreign despots. The rehearsal would not end on a note of despair. God had not utterly cast away his people. They lived in hope and expectation of the coming Messiah of Israel, according to God's word, and the Passover was a time of deliverance. What more natural time and place for him to be revealed? This intense national feeling was responsible for the Roman legionaries placed in strategic positions in and around the city. Jesus had seen them since reaching Jerusalem. To assess the effect of the experience of Jesus during these momentous days is but to speculate. Was it possible that in the silent watches of the night, the God of Israel spoke to the eager, waiting spirit of his Son, and like Samuel there came the ready response, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth"? We do know that on the following day, Jesus went out alone to seek the elders of the city, and oblivious of his parents and the passing of the hours, he talked with the learned rabbis of the great issues of the law and of God's purpose and promises. At the end of 3 days, we see an anxious mother break into the quiet circle and, in her conflicting emotions of relief and distress, cry out, "Son, why hast thou dealt with us? Behold thy father, and I have sought thee sorrowing." We hear his quiet reply, not a rebuke, but rather a declaration that something wonderful has happened in his life, that from now on their old relationship has changed and a new allegiance has begun. "How is it that you sought me? Wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business?" These words introduce us to Jesus. For the first time in the Gospel record, we hear him speak. Before the clouds take him out of our sight, many are the gracious utterances that will fall from his lips. But in these first recorded words, the purpose of his life is crystallized. "I must be about my Father's business." That resolution was to make great demands of him. It was to put him to the test in the wilderness, to try him amongst seething, clamouring multitudes, to strain relationships and to bewilder his dearest friends. It was to demand a loyalty in which earthly relationships were to be forgotten, his brethren being those who did his Father's will. It was finally to make the supreme demand on life itself. The life of Jesus is the record of how Jesus did all these things with quiet confidence and unflinching faith, and with a clear perspective of the work he was doing in relation to the purpose of his Father. The first demand this resolution made was by no means the lightest to the eager spirit of Jesus. His Father's business led him away from these rabbis, back over the Samaritan hills to the carpenter's shop, and kept him there for no less than 18 years. It was a severe test. Nothing loosens the will more quickly than an inability to accept its challenge. Nothing breeds doubt more insidiously than inactivity. There is no greater test of patience than indeterminate waiting. It is a lesson which all the disciples of Jesus must learn. So often, especially in the eager devotion of youth, obedience to the call of God is thought to imply an entire redirection of the whole life. There are new worlds to conquer, deep wrongs to right, great deeds to be done. slowly we realise that the Father's business takes us back to the carpenter's shop, to the things we thought we might have left behind, to the slow discipline of patience and steadfast devotion, to a long period of waiting upon God. But we can be sure that as Jesus went about his duties at the carpenter's bench, subject to his parents, there was new light in his eyes. He recognised his Father's will and submitted to it gladly. Although in his new relationship he was to learn the desolation of loneliness, he was also to learn that he was never really alone, for he lived in the abiding consciousness of the nearness and the love of his Father. And that too, in humbler measure, can be the experience of everyone who comes to the Father through him.